Issues today in terms of some of the evolution of end-of-life care stuff. Some of you were able to see the DAX film online, or you got the disc. And some of you may have seen some of the media coverage on Kruzan. You see any of the tapes? Anybody seen that stuff? Okay, so some did, some didn't. I want to come back to that in a second, but let me tell you how we'll go today. I have couple of distinctions that I want to introduce that kind of come out of the early fighting about Quinlan and the court opinion in that case, this big long article. I want to say a little bit about active versus passive, because it's going to come up a lot in how people think about what's permissible and isn't permissible in end-of-life care. I'm going to say something about brain death, because that turns out to be a big issue in thinking about how to manage dying. Historically, particularly important, but for those of you still thinking about papers, brain death is just as contentious today as it was, I think, when people first started talking about it. It hasn't actually sort of settled down as an issue, despite a lot of pronouncements that it should. That was that Wall Street Journal article that I tried to get out to you fast. This guy has a book coming out tomorrow, a book that basically is full of, you know, you don't want to be an organ donor because they're going to cut you apart alive and you'll be in a lot of pain and your blood pressure will go up, so we know you're suffering, and it's sort of like, and I have a little exercise for us to do about an assisted suicide case that Ed actually sent to me. I'd been following it, but I didn't realize it was getting up in front of a judge in England. And that gets us to the assisted suicide issue, which is sort of the descendant of some of the fighting that started with Kruzan. So a lot to do for us today. Going all the way back, so let me start off just with this basic active-passive distinction. This is one of the things that Jim Rachels wrote about in his article. It's a conceptual distinction that's got a whole literature galore on its own right. Philosophers love this subject. It gets us into the question of whether intent matters in action, or is it just kind of outcome, or does it matter if you know what the outcome is? If you like the religious tradition, double effect plays in here a lot, the notion that I can do something that might bring about an unacceptable end. As long as I don't intend that end, I was trying to achieve another end. And so if the baby's head is stuck in the woman's birth canal at birth, I don't really intend to do an abortion. But if I have to save the mom's life, I may have to try to remove the baby that's stuck. And if the baby dies, well, that's sad, but I didn't really set out to do an abortion. I set out to save the mom. But that sounds okay, except then if I do something that basically destroys the baby, it seems to some people hard to justify a double effect kind of principle, because I know that if I sort of crush or damage the baby to get it out, I'm going to pretty likely kill it, and then what was the, you know, I can't sort of deny the consequence yet. You're too soon. I didn't give it out yet.
Oh, sorry.
You can be guilt-ridden, though. I like that. That's good. So double effect had this notion that you could undertake morally certain actions that you don't intend the outcomes, but if the outcome arises, you will not be responsible for it. And I think the philosophical question there is, to what extent can you accept that difference if you know with certainty that the outcome you don't want is going to happen? To put it another way, double effect works better the less you know, or the earlier you try it, because if you're not really sure what's going to happen if you do X and Y might happen, I think you could probably say morally, well, I didn't intend Y, I was just trying to do X and Y was sad and I didn't really mean that. But if everybody does X all the time and Y always results, it gets harder to say, I'm going to do X without the intention of doing Y. Everybody follow that? So it seems to me the causal connectedness makes double effect tricky to use, except in instances where some, you know, you might say, oh, I'm going to try and put a stimulus in the economy and see if that will make jobs go up. But you don't realize that by doing that, you're going to, cause the European euro to go down. It wasn't your intent, but because the economy started upticking here, people had less faith in Europe, and so they didn't invest as much there. Or conversely, I put a stimulus in place here, and the job thing starts to go up, but maybe inflation starts. I didn't intend that. Couldn't have really been predicted. So I'm not on the hook for causing the inflation. On the other hand, if every time there's a job stimulus, inflation goes up, it's kind of hard for me to say, well, I didn't know that if I tried this stimulus that this other thing wasn't going to happen, or I can't deny that the other thing would happen. You can't hold me responsible for that. Yeah, it seems to me I can, because it's pretty predictable. If you do it 100 times and it happens 100 times, it's hard to duck under the doctrine of double effect and avoid it. So double effect is one principle that people were always interested in end-of-life care. If I try to take away a particular technology and the person dies as a result, but my goal is to relieve suffering or burden them less, then I'm not responsible if death comes. But of course, if every time I remove X, the patient dies later, it gets harder and harder to say that I'm not responsible for the more distant consequences. So some people try to use double effect, but I think it is, in my view, a little easier to use as a kind of conceptual distinction about responsibility in the end-of-life care area when you're doing newer things or novel things. I don't think you can hold somebody responsible for what they can't reasonably predict, but the more you know, the harder it gets to use that doctrine. Another old favorite, ordinary, extraordinary, it comes up in the Quinlan case. If you had a chance to read it, the court says, we don't care about this, but it is kind of interesting that Mr. Quinlan is Catholic and he is interested in ordinary and extraordinary as a difference. His church is interested in that. They make all kinds of generous statements toward the Catholic Church, and then say, of course, none of this matters to anything we're going to decide, but it's very interesting. I thought their politics of how they presented the relevance of the Catholicism was very, very interesting in terms of being respectful but saying doesn't matter a whit to what we're going to decide, but it's interesting. But the core distinction there they cited was the Quinlans went to their priest, who then had a discussion with the Council of Bishops here, who then had a discussion with the Vatican, and the word back was, if you are doing extraordinary things, you need not do them if all they're doing is prolonging dying or that they cannot reverse the ailment or the disease. So for Quinlan, she's in the severely impaired mental state. They're not quite sure what permanent vegetative state is. In the opinion, they keep talking about vegetative and severely impaired and so on. You can see that idea is just percolating into medicine at the time, but there's no standard diagnostic test or anything to do that anybody's accepted. So the idea is from the church, look, a ventilator for her is extraordinary. It's not ordinary technology. You don't have to use it, or you might put it another way, things that are more novel or experimental, you don't have the same obligation to give them as a doctor or nurse, and you don't have the same obligation or duty to accept them as a patient, as a Catholic patient. But what's the problem with ordinary extraordinary? Right, it's a moving line that moves pretty fast. So yesterday's extraordinary is tomorrow's ordinary, and tomorrow's ordinary is yesterday's out of date, I guess. I mean, you know, things are like moving fast. So it's hard to really hold the line. Still, there may be something of value there saying, look, I admit it changes, but at any given time, what's unusual or extraordinary doesn't have to be done. Who tried to make this argument about babies? I did. I remember I told you last week we were talking about the baby Doe cases. I tried to argue that experimental or extraordinary stuff didn't have to be given to a newborn, even under the baby Doe laws. It was a misinterpretation of what's a therapy versus what's novel or merging, or to put it in another crazy way, if you had a baby born with a malformed heart, you didn't have to do a baboon heart transplant on it. Your parents might ask for it or try to go someplace where they could get it, but it wasn't obligatory to offer it, and it wasn't obligatory to accept it, in my view, because it was extraordinary, if you want to put it that way. It was, I would have put it more as experimental, but the same notion is sort of in play here. So we have, again, just to recap, we've got this notion that what is ordinary has to be given, what is extraordinary is more discretionary. That's a separate distinction. We've got the idea of double effect, and then we have our friend active-passive. A lot of people would say about the Quinlan case at the time, you could withdraw technology, and if she had an underlying disease that would have killed her, it's not your fault that she dies. If her lungs don't work, and you take away a machine that's supporting her breathing, then the underlying fact is she had a fatal lung condition, and all you are doing is allowing nature to take its course. You haven't tried to kill her, you're just allowing something to happen that was going to happen. Rachels, in his article, absolutely has an aneurysm about this. He thinks this is the stupidest argument he's ever heard. He basically says, look, there's no difference between taking away technology like a ventilator, knowing that a person can't breathe, and giving them a lethal injection. They're both going to produce a dead patient at the end of the day. And he says, I don't understand why we get all worked up about active versus passive. So let me turn that around to you all. Anybody want to try for some difference between what might be morally different about actively setting out to cause a patient to die versus passively standing back and letting something lethal take their life? And for those of you on the law end, don't we make distinctions between like first and second degree murder and stuff? Doesn't intent count sometimes? Or it doesn't, shouldn't it? We just say, I really wanted to shoot Joe versus I had a gun and Joe fell over and he cracked his head and I didn't save him. That's second degree, killing Joe. I meant to shoot him, but happily for me, he wound up dead anyway and I didn't have to do much.
I think the double effect argument is valid, though. I mean, if I have a patient who's suffering and in pain, there's a clear distinction between giving that patient a big slug of potassium chloride and giving that patient a big slug of morphine. And take care of one step further, there's a difference between giving a patient 200 milligrams of morphine and having and then giving versus giving a patient 10 milligrams of morphine 20 times because they're still complaining of pain.
Because
my purpose in each dose is to alleviate the pain and suffering.
So one difference might be when I set out to actively do something, it can happen a heck of a lot faster, as opposed to allowing something to happen, which might go a lot more slowly. So forget about the 20 milligrams 20 times. Let's say I get a big bolus of morphine and I'm going to inject it into some patient. Or Jack Kevorkian style, I have my little Thanatron set up with my potassium chloride and a whole, I'm ready to stop this guy's heart. Passively, you're going to live longer. Actively, you're going to be pretty dead after I do something to you right away. Is that a moral difference that counts, ever?
Well, I guess the unintended consequence of the passive approach is that it can prolong suffering.
Mm-hmm. So some might argue it's worse. Rachel does. Right. He says, this is barbaric. Now you're telling me I'm going to have this person dehydrate and starve as opposed to hastening their death because you think it's okay to passively not do anything when they can't eat or drink, but you won't let me help them die? That seems cruel.
There also seems that there's a distinction between what Rachel's saying is there are two extremes and you have to pick one of the two extremes. There are things in the middle that may be superior to either of the extremes. And he doesn't look at those. He doesn't, and he won't accept those.
Yeah. So what's the advantage of being allowing something to happen as opposed to setting out to bring about the death of the patient? What's one kind of difference?
On the patient, there's no difference, but on the actor, there is a difference.
So you may feel different. Now, trust me, psychologically, if I said, here's a big needle, go kill Art, versus let Art dwindle away, you will feel much more like causally you took an act that you're culpable for, responsible for, you may be proud of it, whatever, but it does feel psychologically different to set out and do X as opposed to passively allow X to happen. So one type of difference is psychological. And healthcare providers get into this all the time. Somebody says, we're going to take away this guy's ventilator. How many of you know what pressors are? The blood pressure meds? If you take them away from somebody who's pretty sick, what happens? They die pretty fast. People are much less comfortable about taking them away because the person dies pretty quickly as opposed to something that may make them die slowly, not because of the patient, but because of their own estimation of their role in the outcome. It feels less like they did it. So that's one thing to try for, some notion of, is it psychologically real or is it just voodoo talk that makes you feel better but isn't really morally relevant. It may be psychologically true, but you're kidding yourself. What else might be different about allowing something to happen as opposed to making it happen? And the clue here is time.
Sorry. It's not relevant to time. But my one thought was it's different for the actor, both in terms of emotionally, but also for physicians, there's the generally... there's the pervasive idea that one does not do harm, and for some that seems like a violation. To actively euthanize someone would seem like a violation of that.
True, degree. Although Rachel's is huffing and puffing, right. Saying that really is some kind of voodoo tribal incantation. It makes no sense. You're going to kill them dead one way or the other, so if you feel better because you withdrew something, you didn't start something, as opposed to actively doing it. Remember what I said about double effect? You know what the outcome is. What's the difference?
Well, I guess that you could be wrong in what you think will happen if the person could not die.
So, that's a good one. One advantage of withdrawals as opposed to active killings is sometimes you are in error about what's going to happen. It happened in Quinlan. Quinlan didn't die. They take her ventilator away. She's still here. If you were going to do active euthanasia, somebody should have run in the room and put a pillow on her head. But in fact, the idea was relieve her burden. So if I give 20 doses of morphine and the person has pain relief but doesn't die, I could distinguish between saying, I'm going to give you a big shot of morphine that'll kill you versus a bunch of little shots that'll help you or make you suffer less. Now the 20 little doses might tip you over and maybe you'll die if you're frail, but my intent wasn't to kill you, it was just to relieve the pain. And I'm not sure, I don't have the problem with double effect, maybe I don't know what's going to happen from the 20 doses. But my point is, sometimes in withdrawal, which Rachel doesn't seem to pay attention to, you can be fooled. The patient responds. That is especially interesting in babies. So everybody comes around and says, this baby's never going to make it, the baby's never going to, really sick, going to die, da-da-da. Take everything off, kid's still here. Kid's here 3 days later. Pretty soon, kid's going to college. It's like, what happened here? This is like... So I'm not saying it happens a lot, but it does happen that a passive approach opens the window for the patient to prove you wrong. And that may be morally relevant in thinking about active passive. I guess the other side of it is, in addition to showing that you might be mistaken about what's going on, you do have time in a passive situation to have the person change their mind. So I might say, I don't want to be this way, I don't want to be this way, let me die, but I can then say, after 24 hours, you know, I changed my mind. I don't want to die. Keep, help me again. Put the technology back. there's more room for error control and patient change of mind in a passive situation than an active one. When Jack Kevorkian comes to see you, changing your mind is a pretty limited event. It's kind of over fast and you're gone. So there's not a lot of, let me think about this. I mean, he did give people 24 hours, but if it was a passive death from someone, let's say, who was suffering from a debilitating condition, they could change their mind. They might have had weeks, days, months, longer periods of time. So my response to Rachel's is, I think he's partly right, but I think he's partly wrong. I think there are some things that happen in passive withdrawal of things, not huge differences, but smaller differences that still could be relevant in thinking about why passive might be moral when active might be less defensible. I, for example, testified, I should confess to you, since we're in history here, I actually testified against Jack Kevorkian in a Michigan courtroom, driven there by Pontiac County detectives. It was a hoot and a half.
Did you get paid this time?
No. Still slow on the draw there, like. But Jack showed up in stocks. You may remember pictures of him. He wore in the stockade kind of pilgrim thing, and he had a ball and chain on his leg. It was good theater. I said that part of the issue I had with Jack Kevorkian was that he was too quick to kill his patients. He didn't know them, didn't talk to them very well, and he didn't give them a lot of time to sort of think about what they wanted. Some of his patients said, I don't need a lot of time, I don't want to think about it. Or the surviving people said they were happy that he helped their relative die. There was tension about that. But the notion of, say, assisted suicide Oregon style reflects a waiting period. It's trying to build in that notion of change your mind, get a second diagnosis, are you really sure you're terminally ill, as opposed to a more quick, active intervention. So at one extreme, I thought Jack Kevorkian, and I will tell you I'm not opposed to assisted suicide in every and all case, but in his style of doing it, it was too fast. He didn't know the people, he didn't even know their diagnoses, and if they had psychiatric issues, he didn't try to offer them anything. It was just sort of like, I'm here, you're gone, I don't have a lot of time here, we have to make this all happen in 24 hours. And that seemed to me, that was active euthanasia, but it was sort of rolling very, very quickly without the kind of things you might have picked up on a passive. I'm despairing, I'm depressed, I'm uncertain, I'm bullied, I'm coerced. You might get information in the passive side that would still determine whether you think it's ethical to let somebody die. So time to me matters, even though it looks like causally it may not. I think the time dimension does add a moral difference here. Who is screaming for me? Go ahead. Go away.
In terms of,
are we going to allow somebody to die? In the Quinlan case and some of the historical cases, money was not an issue. Didn't really come up at all in Quinlan. Nobody was saying we've got to let her go because she costs too much or anything like that. There certainly are people who've said, if we don't do something about the enormous cost of maintaining people at end of life, which is probably 30% of all the Medicare budget in the U.S. and is big in other countries as well, it's going to bankrupt us, so we ought to make the path to assisted suicide easier. In general, though, I think adding the money argument is a really bad move in thinking about how to manage dying. It's not that it doesn't cost a lot, and it's not that there aren't a lot of resources spent, but you get into this dangerous situation where you're sort of saying, well, from now on, we'll figure out whether you're worth it to keep alive. And there's no reason to restrict that to end of life. You can do it for anybody. So I think cost is around, and society might say, we're going to limit. I mean, insurance companies limit, right? They put caps on what they will pay. There's a lot of insurance policies pay up to $1 million, and then you're on your own, and that's kind of a money end-of-life care thing. You might say we're not going to build a lot of ICUs, and therefore people will be at greater risk of dying, and that's okay because we're trying to save money in our health system. But at the bedside, it doesn't come up that much. In all honesty, it doesn't. Utilization review, the hospital administrator may be pulling their hair out. They may be winking at Mary to have the ethics committee croak this expensive guy, but they're not really going to come in and say, you know, this is just like the meter's running, and it's, oh, geez, we got to get rid of this guy. Oh, fair enough.
I saw that once in the 80s.
Yeah.
My managed care physician came in and said, can't you move this, the death of this infant along? Mm-hmm. It cost the practice a lot of money.
Yeah. And generally, insurance companies and payers do not go anywhere near this. They're happy to tell you you can't get your medicine. They're happy to tell you you can't get preventive things. They're happy to tell you a zillion things you can't have. But at end of life, no, they tend not to be there. So as much as it looms up, it's not really that big an issue in terms of making decisions about what to do. People will also say, however, conversely, if I'm the family of Karen Ann Quinlan, or I'm the family of anybody who's very, very sick, and I don't have to pay anything, then of course I'm all for continuing things. It doesn't cost me anything. So I don't feel much bite in that regard. Maybe I should feel more pain financially if I want to push.
On the extraordinary, extraordinary, or the ordinary, extraordinary the scale, though, doesn't patient context also change? I mean, for Karen Ann Quinlan, when she's brought in unresponsive and they put a tube in, but that's part of normal resuscitation. That would be considered, it seems like in her position vegetative state,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes extraordinary, and removing it then becomes reasonable. But so you talk about the line moving with the technology, but doesn't mm-hmm. with the patient's clinical evolution.
Do they have enough of these? Everybody get one? Okay. So read it. And then you've got three groups. I'll give you about 10 minutes to talk about this case. Again, pick somebody to talk for the group about it. I want to know what you're going to do. Are you going to let this guy have assisted suicide? That becomes the question. You may not take the route that says this has to be settled by the legislature. That's one of the things that comes up in this little article. I will go find out who called me seven peppers. Must be the DA. The person who kept calling me and calling me was a student. Don't ever do that. Call me once. I'll get the idea. No, no difference from here. What he's asking in part is, could a judge declare it permissible? And that's why I said don't punt it to the legislature. You're going to have to tell me, so to speak. I don't want a Chris Christie solution that says gay marriage. Well, let the legislature. I wanted a referendum. Legislature go stick it in their ear.
Assisted suicide.
Why are we here?
That's what he wants.
Yeah. Even with already, if you could say, take it out.
That's yeah, because that's the whole point of some of these cases is that,
whoever
if you're not committed to, so you can proceed to
No, because the reason
why
the
reason
I suppose if you want to say,
I mean,
you have the right to die.
But it's already was a case in the
so there's no difference between well, the ability and how
this guy has the ability to file this paperwork.
Right. So that's the
clearly
that's why
is cogent, clearly
manipulate
exactly. The question is how does that vehicle get transferred to the body?
We're all cool with this to do with
that.
Yeah, it's just not legal in the UK.
I just need to
know. I know. It is a little bit.
Alright, swing around. You were talking so much, I let you talk longer. Got pretty engaged there. I have to tell you, we were talking about Dax in the film, and I didn't say much about it other than, obviously, he's a person who felt he shouldn't have been treated. There was a little tape in there of the Cruzan coverage, a little bit of a documentary about another case after Quinlan, but I was going to tell you a story on myself that's about media and end-of-life care coverage. There's a woman named Catherine Bouvier who wasn't locked in, but was severely impaired, and she, many years ago, probably 1986, made a request, someone like this gentleman, to have help in dying because she was too impaired to do it herself. She couldn't move enough. And I got called by, I wasn't here then, but I was called by a reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer. And he said, off the record, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, I'm not really that moved by her claim that she needs help because she is getting around in her wheelchair. She had one of those little blow things and she could do stuff. And I said, you know, if she really wanted to end her life, she could drive herself off a building or into a lake. And the headline in the Inquirer the next day was, ethicist says Bouvier should drive herself off building.
Really off the record.
Into traffic.
And then my mother called me from Boston and said, you say a lot of stupid stuff, but this is like ridiculous. Why do you think she should drive herself off a building? And I was like, I am. So in media coverage, there is no off the record, ever. Anything you say is for public use. That's true on Facebook, tweeting, anywhere. If you want to say something about these issues, you should assume also that whatever you say will be read by the patient or the patient's family and friends. They're quite likely to let you know if they don't think what you said was particularly sensitive. And people are hugely interested in the whole question of the person who can't help themselves or do something to end their life, what should happen to them, which is clearly our case here. All right, so, yeah, now what do you, what happened in there? What were you guys thinking about?
Well, so we first got a little bit tripped up along that same line. You know, why does he need help? Because we thought that for Lopkin syndrome, isn't he on a ventilator? So why couldn't he just say, I would like the ventilator removed, and then let it be passive? Yeah, or nutrition. So that was our first kind of, we weren't quite sure. I mean, I know that the point of this discussion was to like work us into a corner where it had to be active. But our first pause was like, couldn't we do this? Mm-hmm. And then we moved on to the question at hand, and I think, you know, first of all, we also weren't sure about the legality of the court preemptively ruling.
Yeah, I don't know.
Happened, but like theoretically, if we could, you know, we thought about some concerns. There was the slippery slope argument made that we didn't want to set a precedent for this necessarily, but I think that we all sort of agreed that if the proper place guards, if the proper safeguards were in place, like for like in Oregon or Montana, that we could overcome those concerns.
By the way, just on the court thing, remember there was an appeal in the U.S. in a case called Glucksberg to try and establish a right to assistance in dying in Washington State. The courts were asked to rule on that, and they said they did not find a constitutional basis to create an entitlement to assistance. While they did find a basis for privacy and not having things done to you. So courts have been asked and have ruled without saying the legislature has to do it. Or
right. But they've ruled,
The Washington State case, no. The Montana case, the more recent case in Montana about assisted suicide, the court said yes. So they don't have a safeguard system right now. They have a court opinion. There's no legislative action so far.
Okay. We discussed that suicide itself was legalized in the 70s, and so if you could take your own life, then you get, you know, boxed into a situation where you're physically capable of taking your own life.
Legalized?
Well,
or
decriminalized? Why can't somebody help you then if you're not capable of doing it yourself? And then we talked about, you know, would physicians be willing to assist the gentleman? And I think the pre-med in our groups agreed that there would be physicians who were, would certainly be willing to help the gentleman. I think we came to a yes consensus.
The Kevorkian case in Michigan, the one I testified at, he was not found guilty. There was no law in the books against assisted suicide. Most states in the U.S. don't have laws against assisted suicide. Some passed them, including Michigan, after Kevorkian, but in de facto, you could say it was decriminalized both suicide and assisted suicide a little bit. I think it was more an omission than it was a kind of recognition of something. Suicide's never been really prosecutable too easily. So that's been a limit there. It kind of hard to get the person punished. So I think that's been partly a practical question. Although you could still fight about the estate and so on, and there are penalties, you know. Insurance policies void on a suicide. If you help this guy, say in Oregon, you would need to pass a law that say the insurance company can't void his insurance policy or other inheritance things because it would be an accepted form. For this gentleman, however, in terms of where the law, forget about what it is in England, I don't know, but if it was here and someone assisted, it's also the case that you should know that juries tend not to convict people. So even after Michigan passed an assisted suicide law, Jack Kevorkian was still going, and they still couldn't convict him in front of a jury because juries basically said, we're not convicting him. It was only until he literally killed somebody on 60 Minutes and taped it that he was convicted. In other words, it wasn't an assisted suicide, it was a killing. He turned the switch on the guy and taped it. So here, I'm not sure that the penalty, if you helped him, even if it was a penalty, I'm not sure it would be applied. That's another, you have to keep in mind, there's discretion from prosecutors, there's discretion from juries. Mercy killings tend to be, when doctors get after me about, oh, I don't know if I could do this because of the legal liability, I have to say, Jack Kevorkian got convicted, it took him an awful, he had to try really hard to get convicted. And most other physicians, when they get in front of juries on these kinds of cases, there's a tiny number that have been brought. I don't know of anybody who went to jail. Just as a matter of thinking about the ethics of it as opposed to the, I'm not going to do it because I'm legally liable kind of thing.
We talked about a lot of the same points, including questioning his intention at the concept in that maybe there are other outlets for him to end his life if he really wanted to. But it seems like he's taking this on as a cause, including from some of the quotes that are given.
By the way, that is true. He's definitely trying to push through a movement or start a movement.
And we figured that, I mean, we at the end said yes. And as far as the precedent set, there were almost two ways we looked at it. One was that this case seems similar to ALS, I think. But also a distinction could be made. Like, locked-in syndrome is pretty specific, and in a way, it could maybe not enter into that slippery slope realm if it is a precedent. So we said yes at the end, and because it seemed like he was really competent enough to fill out make it a cause and an argument and get into the papers with it. And he also expressed that he wasn't sure he wanted to do it yet, but have it as an outlet. So he's already setting a safeguard for himself, but we said if we made it a ruling, we would ensure that there was at least a waiting period, somewhat like some of the Oregon safeguards that are in place.
An interesting point about having it available as opposed to will I use it. One of the criticisms I made a lot about Oregon's legalization of assisted suicide was that people would rush from all around the country to Oregon to be helped in dying. That never happened. That was completely wrong. It turns out that people do not want to leave familiar surroundings to go somewhere and die very often, or they're just too sick and they can't pick themselves out of an ICU and take a plane to Portland or something. So sort of euthanasia tourism was not a big issue and hasn't been in Oregon. But more to the point, the number of people who request pills versus the number of people who use them is probably about 10 to 1. Very few people have actually ended their life in Oregon. Not no one, but in a given year, less than 100. Out of potentially a couple thousand cases who would fit the criteria, but they say that they like having the option. It gives them the courage to go on. For people who don't like suicide or want to prevent it, it may turn out to be more preventative to make the option available than to take it off the table.
So I know in Oregon there's the law that you have to be a resident of the state for so many months beforehand. Do you know if the same is true in the Netherlands?
It is in the Netherlands. It's not in Switzerland. Switzerland does have some euthanasia tourism. Not a lot, again. It's expensive. It's hard. You move away from your family. You're pretty sick. But I think Switzerland also is a little different. It's not doctor-assisted. It's civilian-mediated assisted suicide. So the movement is called Dignitas, and it doesn't have doctors doing it. It just has people... I don't know what they do. They may give you a plastic bag. I'm not sure how they handle it, but they're not doing it with doctor-mediated death. By the way, for those of you who, just as long as we're getting morbid about it, you could go online and find a lot of instructions about how to end your life, including plastic bags and other things. They're up on websites. They're there. People do.
We didn't talk about one other thing, because we were saying he was going for the most difficult thing, like euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, because he can't do it himself. The topic was discussed that either way, a doctor's going to have to intervene, or someone's going to have to intervene to maybe like build him a contraption where he could like say something and end up doing it himself.
There's not much he's going to say. He's pretty locked in.
Well, not say, but however it is he communicates.
You might get an eyebrow twitch out of him. He's pretty locked in. He's probably running it off the eyebrow movement kind of stuff, I think. So, my point is, in asking this, what do we think about having his relatives help as opposed to doctors?
I always think about that, like why it falls on the... I mean, I understand why it's in the doctor's realm, but I always question why it falls on the responsibility of the doctors to do the action.
Mm-hmm. You could have theologian-assisted suicide. You could have pharmacist-assisted suicide. I guess you could have Philadelphia Philly assisted suicide. I mean, you get, there's a lot of people who could help. Part of the answer to that is, again, it goes back to Jack Kevorkian. Kevorkian medicalized assisted suicide with the view that A, it would be more humane and you would sort of do it with less pain and more reliability if you had an expert do it. And B, it was part of the doctor's mission to honor patient autonomy. But there have been, in Switzerland, and the Hemlock Society here is not oriented toward physician-assisted, it's just assisted suicide. You could certainly say, you know, you need a doctor to get the pills, but from there on out, up to you, take them, whatever. So it doesn't have to be doctor-assisted suicide. Again, this is history. It sort of got shaped that way because Kevorkian in the U.S. was such an influential figure, and he believed in doctor-assisted, that it sort of went in that direction. But it doesn't. It certainly doesn't have to be. In some parts of the world, like Switzerland, it isn't. I think doctors also are in a weird position about assisted suicide because they've got a lot of literature on the table, another paper topic, but well, they won't participate in executions. So you got this big, we're not going to do this, but over here maybe we'll do this, but so what's going on? There looks like a kind of, I can't help the prisoner die humanely, but I would help my patient die humanely. Is that consistent or not consistent? Because that's been a long tradition in medicine not to participate in capital punishment for a long time. Not even to the point of pronouncing death. Forget about causing death. Not even to witness it or be involved at all. So the question's fair. It's just kind of interesting that it... I really think Kevorkian drove it historically in this country toward a doctor idea.
A lot of the ideas obviously are repetitive at this point, but we spent a lot of time wondering why this was such a big issue, if it is in fact legal in England to just withhold and withdraw. So
yep,
thinking that they would just be able to remove the vent and provide him with palliative sedation to keep him comfortable. We also talked a little about...
So I think that, by the way, is the fear, suffering.
Right.
I want help so I don't suffer. It's all the way back to Rachel's. If we're dying, I mean, we get the. Now that we've established that I'm going to die, I don't want to suffer. So I need you to help me die quickly, so to speak, or painlessly.
Exactly. Yeah, we also talked about his psychological state. Was he a depressed individual before this occurred? But it's also obviously understandable if he's depressed now with this kind of condition. It's not so much, I think one person said, it's not so much a clinical issue at this point of depression. It's more of an inherently understandable one. You know, anyone in his condition would probably be depressed. But because he seems to be confident and he's telling his family members and the doctors and also that his wife is on supporting, the family supporting the decision, it seems that he should be able to get help in that regard.
We have a professor here at the medical school who's got extreme form of ALS at this point, wheelchair bound, pretty much lost all body control, and he has two children, and he has fought very hard to stay alive and to do what he can to interact with them. Mentally, he's still in there. He's not locked in, but he's pretty close. I know him a bit, and then when I talk to him a little bit, he's not depressed. He finds it satisfying to think about his work and deal with his family and watch his kids grow up and that sort of thing. I'm not saying he never would reach a point, but not everybody is, even in the most miserable, horrible circumstances. That said, I'm sure a lot of people but not everybody. I haven't met, at least there's one case right here where the person is still kind of hanging in there. So a number, sort of to wrap up for today, if you respect autonomy, which is kind of a common theme in our groups, it isn't so hard to move over to say, well, under some circumstances, can't I have help in dying as opposed to allow me to die by taking things away? If you take a more Rachel's view that there's not that big a difference, you can see how you push pretty quickly into the active assisted suicide realm. Still, people in the U.S. have been cautious about assisted suicide. It hasn't rolled through, and even in the places where it's legal, it's very restricted. Terminally ill, gotta wait, you swallow the pills, need a psychiatric consult. It's a pretty restrictive process. It's not as wide open as it is in the Netherlands, which tends to be more of a pain and suffering driven standard as opposed to terminal illness. I think I would have guessed that the fight over assisted suicide legalization would have been hotter and gone further than it did, given what Oregon and Washington did. But it hasn't really moved. Montana had this court case, which is kind of interesting. Hawaii was thinking about assisted suicide recently. It's a state legislative issue. I think something got introduced in Vermont. Last question for today. Why didn't it take off more? Why wasn't the push stronger for assisted suicide in the U.S.?
My opinion is that towards the end of life, to say that you're autonomous when you're under a lot of pain and, you know, sort of suffering, a lot of family issues and so on and so forth, you know, that becomes a little bit more of a sort of a gray zone. So the slippery slope, as you talked about before, comes more into play. Mm-hmm. People are quite cautious about it.
I think another thing is the fact that when all this came up, shortly thereafter, the whole hospice movement began to blossom. And that alleviated a lot of the pressure for PAs.
So to me, that's the number one reason. Medicine looked at this sort of push a little bit toward assisted suicide and basically said, we are doing a terrible job, palliative care-wise, emotionally, spiritual support for people who are dying. We've got to do better. In Oregon, part of the reason people don't use assisted suicide as much as they really tried very hard to upgrade their, what we would call, palliative care services, but I mean it in the broad sense. And a lot of other places have too. So hospice and palliative care took off. They turned out to be acceptable options for a lot of folks, and some of the push for assisted suicide tamped down. I think the big issue, just to leave you with one, is I think a lot of this was cancer-driven, AIDS-driven, I don't want to suffer. But if you have more people around who suffer dementia, Alzheimer's, loss of dignity, is that the next place where the sort of discussion or debate about assisted suicide is likely to go? I mean, I happen to think it is. Pain control is better, suffering better, but now you sort of see more people living long enough so that some number of them get Alzheimer's or Parkinsonism or strokes, mini strokes. And a lot of folks would say, I don't want to be that way, even though it's not suffering. I mean, for all I know, an Alzheimer's patient's pretty happy. You know, they're not, you know, not in pain. But for a lot of folks, that's not a state they want to be in. So I think that may be, that if that population grows, that may actually revivify the debate because it's not solved by palliation. We'll see. All right.